Good morning. This is Focus 580, a morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. In October of 2003, the company known as Apple Computer released a device called the iPod. A small, sleek, off-white rectangle with a scroll wheel and five buttons, the iPod was the first music player that allowed you to hold 1,000 songs in your pocket. Since then, the iPod has become an icon of the digital media revolution, transformed the music industry, and changed Apple from a boutique computer company to a mass-market consumer electronics powerhouse. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the impact of the iPod with veteran journalist Stephen Levy. He is a senior editor and chief technology correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's also the author of several books about technology and its impact, including a book just out entitled The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness, published by Simon & Schuster. We interviewed Stephen Levy last week when he was visiting the University of Illinois to speak about his new book. As this is a pre-recorded interview, obviously we can't take your calls on the air during this hour of Focus 580. Well, Stephen Levy, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I'm very glad to have you. I wanted to, of course, talk about your book, The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. And just to kind of kick things off, I wanted to just whip out my little Rio 600 player that I bought several years ago. There have been a number of MP3 players available before the iPod. I don't remember when the first one became available, but probably at least two or three years before the iPod. But the iPod is something in a different category altogether, isn't it? I mean, why is it so different, in fact, perhaps revolutionary?
That's right. Well, the iPod actually was born from the inadequacy of the MP3 players that came before it. Apple wanted to have a player to go along with some software that they developed for the Macintosh. They bought a company that and developed the program called iTunes from it, which was one of those digital jukeboxes. They felt they had the best one and thought it would be a great asset for the Macintosh, but then looked around and saw there was no really great players. They decided to go off and do their own. Now, when Apple sets off to do this, they have these higher standards, and they had a vision of doing something that would be not only better than what had come before, but something that was so much better, it would be something else entirely. And amazingly, they largely succeeded in that with the iPod. So there were a couple things that distinguished it from things that came before. First of all, it had a hard disk drive. Now, there had been some others, MP3 players with hard disk drives, but they were much bigger, clunkier, and they were very difficult to navigate with. And that was a key attribute, because if you had a hard disk drive, you could hold a lot of songs. How are you going to find the one you want? How are you going to choose which songs to play? So they had a great interface. They had this developed the wheel, which everyone's familiar with now, that labels your finger to run around in a little circle there, and very quickly scroll through to find the song you wanted. And the combination of those wheels and the buttons around it actually was quite a cunning way to navigate. And again, in keeping with Apple's expertise, they're a great interface company. So that's different. Also, it just looked great. Apple's a great design company. So they have their best person work on it, and they started off with, like, of course, the high standards of Steve Jobs, their CEO. So it was a beautiful object. And then they decided that it would work just totally in lockstep with this one piece of software that lived on your Macintosh at the time, this iTunes. And they had a high-speed connection that you could very quickly sync it. So basically, they solved all the problems that you had with MP3 players in the past and were able to give you something new, which was, for the first time, a really usable device where you could get a music collection in your pocket. That was their motto, and I think it was a good one. And it came out, and it took actually the world a little while to figure out what was going on, but it turned out to be somewhat revolutionary.
Well, it not only transformed people's ability to carry a library of songs in their pocket, but transformed Apple as
a company.
That's
right. Yeah, as Apple broadened the market for it. Originally it was for Macintosh. Macintosh only has a 5% market share. So they changed their strategy. they said, let's make it for Windows as well. Let's make iTunes for Windows, and we'll let the iPod sync to that. And fortunately, there was a high-speed connection you could use for Windows down the road, which was called USB 2.0, a little mm-hmm. techie term. But people use it. It's just the thing you plug in your iPod into the Windows computer. And then they added this store where you could buy digital songs online legally, and they had those three parts with the iTunes, the iPod, and the store available to everyone. The thing really took off, and that changed Apple, because all of a sudden, from being a company which was used to operating in a playing field where they owned a little part of the market, they had the premium part of a big market, they had the giant part of a growing important market.
Well, it's interesting the timing of this, because at the time, there was, outside of iTunes, and there were a few sort of fumbling attempts by a couple of the major labels to establish an online presence, but they sort of crippled themselves, didn't they? I mean, this was an opportunity for Apple to just do something that hadn't been done before, except, Napster, perhaps, which was had a whole set of problems.
That's right. When it comes to buying songs online, the digital rights management is called. Those are the rules that supposedly are focused on stopping piracy and limiting what you can do when you buy a song online. They were so onerous in the previous models that it just wasn't worth going through. It was not going to be popular because essentially, before the iTunes store, what the arrangements had you do was spend as much, if not more, money on buying music with less things you could do with it. It just wasn't flexible at all, and you kept running into all the rules and regulations that stopped you from making copies, even for your own personal use, The quality wasn't good. It was just a mess, and it was hard to get and slow and limited selection. And Steve Jobs, again, took a look at what was going on and said, I have to put my customer first. What do people want to do? And instead of sitting down with the record labels and negotiating what he could do, he outlined the whole system. He did the whole thing in-house. He worked with his people to figure out what would be a reasonable way to allow people an opportunity to buy songs. He borrowed a little from Amazon in terms of the way the store looked. But the key thing was he said that, okay, we're going to have these DRM copy protect rules, but they're going to be much more relaxed, and people aren't going to bump into them. So, and he presented this pretty much a fait accompli to the labels. Very carefully picked which ones to approach first. Wooed a couple key executives at a couple labels, got them to sign up. There were five at the time. And then worked at the middle ones. And in the last, they were all in line except one, Sony, which he knew was going to be the toughest one because they were hardliners on copy protection because they owned a record label as well as being an electronics company. And being his rival, I guess they didn't want to see him do too well against them. But by that point, he was able to say to them, everyone else is in but you. How are you going to face your customers if you say you're the one that stops this opportunity to buy music legally? How are you going to criticize people when they steal music when you won't let them buy it legally? And they came on board, and the rest is history. They sold millions of songs really in the first month, and they're up to 2 billion now.
It's amazing looking back on this period how many of us were clamoring for something like the iTunes Store. I mean, there were things like Napster, which you could, share music online simply by searching other people's collections in a peer-to-peer kind of fashion. They were distributed all over the planet, basically. But a lot of that was illegal.
There were two problems with Napster. The first was it was illegal. Interestingly, The record labels, by not making an arrangement with Napster, I think lost a generation. When I talk to students, I'd be curious to know if your listeners would agree with this. I'm a little taken aback at the degree to which they feel it's okay to get music free on the internet. They, the record labels, and their representatives have made a big deal about the morality of stealing music from the internet and try to say it's the exact equivalent of going to a store and shoplifting. Young people don't think that. It's just a fact. And I think partly the reason why they don't think it is they don't think very much of the morality of the record companies. They feel that the record companies have unfairly leveraged their monopoly in music. They overcharge. I don't know whether many of them are aware of the history of ripping off artists, but if they are, that's another reason. Payola is another reason. But basically, when you look for shining moral examples, record company executives aren't the first people to come to mind. But I think basically it was the idea that it just felt so natural to use Napster. The second part of difficulty with it was it really was not a great experience, a great user experience. It was sometimes hard to find the songs you wanted. It would seem like they were at someone's computer. You'd connect. The handshake wouldn't happen. Sometimes you would go for a while. You'd take a while to download the song. It was very slow. And you'd get it on your computer, and there'd be a gap in things. Someone didn't record it right. And then the record companies actually started tinkering with the process. And, I think Madonna herself got involved. And instead, you'd think you were downloading a Madonna song. Instead, it was just someone cursing or something and calling you an idiot. But, basically, it wasn't a pleasant experience. It wasn't an aesthetically attractive interface. It was a problem. So there was an opportunity to compete with free here and saying, if we're going to give you an experience which is pleasurable to use, you'll find what you want. And it'll download fast, guaranteed to work. You'll pay $1 for a song. That's not too much.
Well, and that was the feeling I had, and a lot of other people had at the time. Just give us the option, to pay for the music. That's great. And before iTunes Music Store, there really wasn't a very good option.
No, there wasn't. And it is, I think, a generation, maybe you're my generation that would be more likely to pay. And, But I think if you give the convenience, everyone will be happy to. Yeah. 99 cents, I believe, actually, is too high to pay. I think that if you look at the economics of digital commerce, right, we're not making things, and sending them to stores and shipping them in trucks and warehousing them and worrying about returns here. This is something you just put one copy up there on a server, and that could serve millions of people. So, it doesn't cost much to do that, and they will make more money by cutting the price and selling more bits. And I think that's a lesson the record companies have yet to learn.
And I think you mentioned in your book that in fact, the actual return to the labels of a tune sold through iTunes is much greater than it would be on a CD through a store.
That's right. Because there's no product involved, they get a very high license fee. They get two-thirds of that dollar, which is extraordinary. You look at a Walmart and the cut they get from a CD there, and it's much lower. Especially you got the manufacturing costs in there. My suspicion is the artists don't get all that fair a share from that cut, but whether they do or not, that's a lot of money. And Apple actually does not make very much money from the iTunes Store because they have all their costs. They handle the billing, the credit card, and by the time it's all over, that 32 cents or whatever it is a song barely covers expenses.
So going back to the iPod, which came out after the iTunes Music Store, it just took off. I mean, can you give us a sense of how successful the iPod has been? How fast has been its sort of adoption and spread throughout? I mean, not just, people using it to listen to music, but actually as a sort of a cultural icon.
That's right. Well, it came out in October 2001. And again, you have that 5% market share. So it actually did pretty well. It sold in the hundreds of thousands, over the next few months. It really wasn't until, as I said, the Windows version came out, the iTunes Store came out, that it really began taking off. And what it did was it jumped out from, as you mentioned, the idea that by then it really had a cultural cachet. In the first few months of the iPod being on sale, you could actually see when someone was listening to an iPod because it has those distinctive white earbuds. And this was something that I don't think was intentional on Apple's part. They just made the earbuds white because the iPod was white, and it just fit that way. I don't think they really realized that it would be a signifier. And when you had an iPod, you saw someone else with those white earbuds. They were a member of your tribe. And also, the iPod was taking on a little bit of a cultural cachet, and you were part of the cool tribe. And other people wanted to get in on that. And when they had the opportunity to do that, and also the price came down, you know, giving more people an opportunity to do that. Originally, the cost was $400. And some people gasped when they heard that because they thought, boy, that's a lot for a little thing that just plays music. You know, transistor radios don't cost like that much. Walkman don't cost that much. So the price came down. And all those things conspired to make the iPod really burst through. It really sort of popped in the population and the culture and became more than a device. It was an identity signifier. It said who you were, and people wanted to know what's on your iPod. And so all those things worked in Apple's favor, and the fact that people who got the iPod really liked them and they talked about them obsessively. If you ever talk to someone who's just had an iPod, they won't shut up about it.
It's kind of amazing connection people have to this thing. I mean, I have an iPod, and I must say I'm, you know, probably a little older than the early adoption crowd or the younger people that are sort of immersed in all this technology. I'm more of an immigrant than a naturalized citizen, but it is an amazing psychological phenomenon. You write about people who, you know, lost their iPod and went into almost shock or something.
That's right. Yeah, it's a deep wound. Actually, I just lost an iPod myself about a month ago, and I had to go back to an earlier version. I had a brand new 80 gig iPod, fifth generation, and it was tough. But nowhere near as tough as some other people. One guy dropped his iPod on the tracks of the New York subway, and he actually jumped down to get it. Risking life and limb.
Yeah.
Man, these things only cost $250. You know, let's not go overboard here. But people name their iPods. Some people make clothes for their iPods. They get very, very attached. And a lot of people who don't lose the iPods just obsess with worry about losing them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're, you know, they're just always kind of feeling, make sure it's in their pocket and it's near them because, you know, losing would be the worst. The guy who was the producer of the TV show, The OC. He was a huge iPod fan, and someone took his iPod from his car, and it was a deep traumatic experience for him.
Yeah, and I found it amazing. You write about people leasing apartments who would offer an iPod to people who, you know, signed on the dotted line to lease his apartment, whereas before they might have been offering, you know, a month or two free rent, which would be, you know, maybe a couple $1,000. You know, they got better response from offering a free iPod.
That's right. And you see it all the time in bank premiums. It used to be they give you a toaster. Now they give you an iPod Shuffle or something like that. And it's because when you get an iPod, someone says to you, oh, here's, you know, $200. Well, that's great, $200. But they give you an iPod and it's, you know, wow, I've got a new iPod. It seems as better than money. The idea that you could spend your $200 and buy an iPod isn't quite the same as the impact of someone just giving you an iPod. Even if you have an iPod and at bar mitzvahs, you know, people sometimes get, kids, you know, get four or five iPods and they don't give them back. They're happy with them.
Yeah. There is. I want to go back to the issue of piracy and copyright and sort of the way people, you know, their attitudes about their rights to music or, you know, the greed of the labels or, you know, the whole environment we're kind of trying to come to some better understanding of and economic model that supports. You know, an iPod can have, what, 10,000 songs or something
like
that?
Yeah, I think 20,000 is the 80 gig, right?
Okay, 20,000 songs. I mean, if you paid 99 cents per song on iTunes. Now, presumably, you're going to rip some songs off CDs you've already bought, but let's say theoretically, I mean, that you could have $20,000 worth of music on one iPod.
That's right.
I've seen some. I don't know if they're actual studies or, you know, anecdotal to some extent, that most of the people who own iPods have some content on that iPod that they haven't bought, that perhaps they, you know, that they got through some peer-to-peer sharing network or whatever. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, given the labels embracing of the whole model of selling through the iTunes Music Store and online music in general, there seems to be some real confusion and conflict still in this whole space about that.
That's absolutely right. Now, I look at those statistics a different way. So they found that I think the average amount, you know, so there's figure there's 90 million iPods sold, and they've sold 2 billion songs on the iTunes store, right? So that comes to, you know, maybe a few CDs worth of songs, maybe 30 or 40 songs for each iPod sold. Okay, some of the iPods, probably people have multiple iPods, right? So you wouldn't need to have duplicate songs there. A lot of people have big CD collections. Some people don't buy on the iTunes store because they don't like the DRM. They buy a CD.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the new Lucinda Williams album. I ordered it from Amazon. It cost me $10, you know, no free shipping.
Mm-hmm.
In their premium shipping program. I could have got it from the iTunes store, but I have it without DRM. I think it's better that way. And, you know, if it's quality, I don't have to worry about backing it up. So it's, the experience, you know, in some sense still has a way to go in terms of value. If I would offer that for the iTunes store for $3, you know, I probably would have bought Lucinda from them. But so there's that. So, but if you think about it, the iPod hasn't been around for that long. A lot of people who have iPods probably aren't going to buy that much more CDs anyway. How many mm-hmm. CDs do you buy? So what you do is you fill it up with your CD collection, maybe your friend's house, you fill mm-hmm. it up with some more. Is that lost sales for the music industry? I don't think so. I think what happens is that by having a lot of songs on your iPod, you're going to listen to songs more. And you're going to be a bigger music consumer in general. Maybe you'll go to more concerts. Maybe you'll look out for new bands, new ways to hear new stuff mm-hmm. on your iPod. And you're going to put money into that economy, into that music economy more. So I don't think you could make that equation saying, oh, the iPods mean the songs are being stolen. Before the iPod got here, that's, you know, there was as much stealing as there ever was with Napster online there. So I think that stealing goes on whether you have iPods or not. The question is, how do you build an audience and then tailor the business to the possibilities you have with digital music distribution and iPods, which you have now? I think it's actually a time of opportunity, not a time of threats for the music industry.
Okay. Another thing people are doing with their iPods is this thing called podcasting. So they're consuming material, whether it's music or talk radio or various other things that people produce. Either, you know, individuals who have blogs and, of course, news organizations like NPR and certainly WILL, we produce podcasts that people can download and listen to our programs anytime on their iPod.
Okay, will this be podcast?
This will be podcast, in fact. Every local program here is podcast, and we have a huge and growing audience for those podcasts. A lot of people are sort of unaware. It's sort of still a fringe activity on the internet, but those who are aware of it, many of them really are, you know, very dedicated consumers because they can time shift their listening that way. Well, you know how it works. This is something that has sort of taken off in the media.
It's interesting. Now, you're right. Podcasting is still in, you know, on its upward curve, but podcasting was incredibly obscure before it got named podcasting. The technology had been around for a couple of years, and you know the people involved in it were this guy Dave Weiner and Adam Curry, who used to be an MTV VJ. Chris Lydon, you know, who is from Boston, reminded me he was involved in one of the first podcasts. But it wasn't until the technology enabled you to post something on the internet and subscribe to it automatically, you know, get a feed, as it's called, of an audio presentation or even a video one. It was named podcasting, and that just came about in 2004. Did it take off? Because it attached itself to the cachet of the iPod, the excitement of the iPod. It didn't have to be the iPod. It could have been any music player, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you could just do it on the computer, really,
yeah.
Without a music player. But by being associated with the iPod, that helped bring it to more people's attention, and it became a cool thing to do. And also, Apple then sort of in a little reverse act, you know, a little bit of jujitsu there, then decided, well, you know, podcasting, we like this. We're going to put podcasts on the iTunes Music Store, which was a huge development. And I'll tell you, I've been following technology for a long time and seen a lot of things kind of come out from the grassroots and take a sort of a slow adoption curve, blogging and other things. I've never seen something take off as quickly in terms of being adopted by established players as podcasting was. Really, within a few months of podcasting being named, places like NPR, Newsweek on Air, other really big operations adopted podcasting and began podcasting their their shows and sometimes even their video stuff. And a nice thing happened that it didn't push out the little guys, you know, the obscure stuff, the stuff people make in their basement or their closets. That still is pretty popular. So now you go to get podcasts and you really are, belly to belly. The Dawn and Drew show of this crazy married couple living in Wisconsin, it just goes belly to belly with This American Life.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. Well, and for us, I mean, we saw when iTunes first started supporting podcasts, had a podcast tab in the iTunes interface, our MP3 downloads jumped from about 5,000 a month to about 24,000 the next month, to 48 to about 90,000, right after June 2005 when that came out. It was
astonishing. That's amazing. It's interesting. A lot of people subscribe to a lot of things. I'd be curious to know how much you wind up listening to. It's like you have a TiVo and you record a lot of songs, TV shows.
Right.
And every time you get home, it's like, oh no, I've got to go through this. I got 12, 20 hours of stuff to watch. Some of it won't be watched, but it's nice. I take a plane ride and, there's a dozen potential podcasts to listen to, and some I always try to listen to, and some I like to experiment with.
Well, this is a question that I always like to ask people, and I'm especially curious about your answer to this. Are you listening to more music or other material, whether it's news or talk shows, like open source and so forth? Has the iPod changed your listening habits, and how so? If that's
true? Yeah, well, it's dramatically changed my listening habits, and that's one reason I was interested enough to write a book, is that it really had a huge impact on me. It changed my music listening habits dramatically. I've always been a big music fan, but in recent years, found it difficult to find time to listen to music. I live in a New York City apartment. There's three people in the apartment, and it's not always a clear path in the living room to put on a CD and listen to it, with people going in and out and distractions and stuff to do. The iPod has given me a space to listen to music again. And then because of the things we've been talking about before, I've been able to experiment and find new music and listen to music more. In terms of podcasts, definitely. New York is not a great radio environment. We don't drive around in our cars. When I'm outside the city, I wind up listening to a lot more radio than I do when I'm in the city. But this way, I could take my favorite radio shows and collect them and discover new ones. So I could listen to the Grateful Dead Hour and This American Life and other things and podcasts of interesting people, like Liz Phair podcast, and some of my favorite artists, and the Ricky Gervais podcast, which is hysterical that he did a series of podcasts, the guy who did The Office in the UK. There's a lot to listen to, a lot to find.
Apple unleashed the iPod in October 2001, and it's really hard to believe that more than 5 years have passed since then. The first graphical web browser, Mosaic, was created just 12 years ago, by the way, about three blocks from where we're sitting right now.
I just talked to Mark Andreessen last week. I interviewed him for Newsweek.
Right, that's great. Given the rate of technological development and the cultural change that has come with that, it's hard to really fathom the implications. You write, "What had compelled me in the first place to devote my career to chronicling the digital revolution was my belief that this was the biggest story of our time." Do you believe that we're living in a time that will be viewed hundreds of years from now as a truly pivotal moment in our history?
Absolutely. The computer itself was developed not much more than 50 years ago. Really, the very first computers, and you really you're even pushing it to say that what you had in World War II was a computer, and the personal computer, 1975. We could pinpoint the year there, right? So that's barely 30 years. The impact that those have had with the internet, which again started as something quite different in the late 60s and evolved into what we know as the internet. Those two things combined, I think, are changing humanity. I think we're just the very beginning of these things. You know, these are basically baby technologies with unlimited potential. That's what computers are all about, unlimited potential. And I think as computers move more to the area of biology, I wrote a book called Artificial Life a few years ago, it's going to change what humans are. So I really feel that this is an amazing time to watch what's happening in that world. And I feel pretty lucky to have been given the opportunity to talk to the key people and to be writing for the places I write, like Newsweek, where I've been for the last 11 years, to cover this revolution and see things like the Garry Kasparov Deep Blue match, where a computer beat the best chess player who ever lived, which I think was a great symbol for the process that's going on now.
You write for Newsweek and New Yorker and other publications about media convergence. This term media convergence, which I'm not sure I'm completely comfortable with, it's something that the media industry is grappling with, that we're trying to figure out. I use "we" very loosely because a lot of different players and they're grappling in different ways. How to incorporate the internet in their media operations as news organizations, as cultural, authors, as people who are trying to address what's going on in society, grappling with the changes that the technology enables them to do. I guess I'm really curious what your take is on the effect of the internet, computers, and internet media on the media industry. Where are we in the process of the evolution of that?
Let me tell you a story that I think illustrates it pretty concisely. So I mentioned Mark Andreessen dropped by, and I'd first met him, I guess, when he was starting Netscape, not long after he left here. I visited him in 1994 in Silicon Valley back then. And he came by showing me his latest product, this thing called Ning. And I said, "Mark, I want you to take a look around here at Newsweek." We're sitting in sort of an open space near where my office is. The whole place is full of boxes, and half the magazine almost is moving their office from one place to another, including me. And that's because there's more and more web people who work for our website, and where our normal staff is getting a little smaller mainly, fortunately, by attrition, and they haven't been tossing us out in the street. But we've been taking on more people working for the website. We've been writing more for the web. And you could literally see the effect of the internet on this established mainstream media publication as, the people are moving in, like other offices are going empty, and we're shifting, trying to figure out where we are. Mm-hmm. Should we be a web publication? What's the meaning of something in Newsweek and the print edition and in the web edition? These are big questions. Will our revenue migrate from print to the web? Our revenue is growing on the web, but the big money is still on the print ads. They're our most expensive thing we sell. Often we sell the two together. And this is something I think that's going on in every newspaper. And some of the newspapers are particularly threatened because the main source of their revenue is the classified ads. There's this place called Craigslist, which does classified ads for free. And Craig is very happy with giving things away, and he doesn't even want too much money coming in. So Craig is sort of revolutionary in his own way. Every media outlet from news to entertainment, we talked about music, it goes for the movies, is being challenged by this new form of distribution, which is not only more powerful than any other previous form of distribution because it reaches people instantly, and there's no physical limit to how much you could distribute. And on the other hand, people can get it very easily. You need a new business model. Our previous business models were based on scarcity. So now navigating that is going to be a challenge. I have to feel that it's a good thing to have a medium where everything moves so easily. And I have to hope that in terms of news, it's the news that people buy, that people want to see, that people continue to want to see, and that somehow will match up their need and desire to get the news with some model by which they could pay for it.
Well, that's really the question for a lot of the organizations, that some of whom seem like they're panicking almost, especially as you say, the newspaper industry is challenged by this. It seems on the one hand incredibly hopeful for people who want access to information, that are able to get access to information. And, you know, a lot of it is now free, and perhaps, you know, most of it is actually free. But what does that do to the existing organizations that depended on a revenue stream based on broadcast signals and advertisers and classified ads?
Right. There was a great moment at a blog conference a couple of years ago, maybe about a year, not only about a year and a half ago. One of the outside speakers was Jill Abramson, who's one of the top editors of the New York Times. And she was going back and forth with the bloggers who were, you know, sort of adamant in their insistence that, you know, the grassroots media was the way to go, citizen journalism. And she said, does anyone know how much it cost the New York Times to run its bureau in Baghdad? And she told them the figure. I forget what it was, but it was some millions of dollars, yeah. Obviously. Something that the blogosphere is not coming up with there. And there was sort of a moment of silence. And then they actually got angry at her, saying, like, you know, that's an unfair thing to say. You know, but I think it was a great point. Yeah. Who's going to run those bureaus if the New York Times can't make its money? And it's a serious question. I mean, right now, I think if you look at television news, even the network news, there's been, you know, sort of dramatic cutbacks in their bureaus and what they do and the amount of freelance they use, and also the way that the news has gone soft. And if they're covering AIDS in Africa, it'll be because Angelina Jolie is there as opposed to doing an investigative piece themselves, because they need those ratings. And I think it's not a foregone conclusion that we're going to wind up with the news that we want and deserve. Maybe we will wind up with the news we deserve, but that won't be all that much.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, to be fair, some of those trends about the way the news media covers or doesn't cover things may not be based on, you know, the internet economics that's, you know, affecting how they can operate. And, you know, I mean, it seems that we went for the cable news channels went for Runaway Bride instead of, you know, Darfur as
right.
a story. You know, and that was because they felt that was in their best interest as an entity that has to support itself.
Yeah, but if you look at the big media picture there, so it's all sort of interconnected there. So we moved away from a model, and it was a technology doing this, where we had the broadcast model based on totally on scarcity, right? There's only a certain amount of licenses for the piece of the spectrum that the networks, you know, then the radio stations or TV stations in an individual area could broadcast to. And because of that, because they had those coveted licenses, they had a public service requirement mm-hmm. to fulfill. Now, in a much broader media landscape, we've got all the channels we want. The whole idea of over-the-air broadcast, this seems antiquated. If they pull the plug on that, there wouldn't be many people who missed it, really. So what happens to the commitment that the networks have? Mm-hmm. If you wanted to do all Angelina Jolie news and actually take, you know, the approach of a cable network to news, which is sort of semi-news in most cases, there's no one to say you're not fulfilling your public broadcast. They would say, look, this marketplace is so broad that, you know, news will find its way. You know, and if it doesn't, then the marketplace has spoken. So, you know, and this is all the technology. As we get, you know, we have hundreds of channels now. I think the next step is the internet TV with hundreds of thousands of channels. And that's not an exaggeration. Hundreds of thousands of television channels. And, you know, will some of those spend $20 million for to cover a war in Iraq? I hope so.
The 20,000 channel video future, in a way, it's kind of here with YouTube and, you know, some of these things. I mean, they're not exactly channels, most of them, but, you know, anyone can publish media at this point. Whether they have a significant audience is a different story. But the idea of user-generated content is a big one in the media industry right now, and it seems to be generating a lot of enthusiasm and perhaps hope that, you know, in public broadcasting, for example, just speaking for us, that we can do our jobs, but we can serve our mission better. We can serve people better by, in a sense, allowing people to participate in the creation of media and to make meaning of the media that is created. I guess I'm curious what you see in terms of, you know, sort of participatory culture in media, in terms of trends, whether you think that's going to result in something truly useful or merely interesting.
Well, I think it's going to be truly useful. It is truly useful already. I do, again, it's an open question what happens to the pros. There is one school of thought which says, you know, what will happen is in the user-generated content world is that some people will be so good at it and build such a following that they'll effectively turn pro. So what you'll have done is just basically expand your talent pool for the people who, you know, are going to find broad audiences. And that's a good thing. On the other hand, if the real pros have difficulty competing and, you know, and as well as the pros that come from beneath, once you get there and you say, hey, now I want to make a living now, the stable living, and it's tough to do, then we're at a loss for something. I love the Wikipedia, you know, which is sort of the iconic example of user-generated content, right? But there's some disturbing things about it. Recently, The New Yorker did a story about the Wikipedia. And one of the people who they wrote about was a person who the author of the article never met, but interviewed and, you know, described, as he described himself, as a professor of religion, who was, you know, the head of a religion department in a well-known school, who chose to do his Wikipedia work under a pseudonym. But he watched all the entries in that field and would often invoke his expertise in the subject as, you know, a PhD professor on that. Well, as it turned out, that person was a 24-year-old who had never graduated college, mm-hmm. who was posing as a professor. And Jimmy Wales, who's the head of the Wikipedia Project, his initial reaction when they told him about this was, well, he just chooses to have a pseudonym. That's his choice. And, you know, and Wales actually had just recently hired this person for his, you know, a new project, there was going to be a for-profit offshoot of Wikipedia there. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty disturbing to me because, you know, to me, this whole idea is about trust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you trust the information, if someone, you know,
they're lying about who they are. I mean, yeah. How do you trust them?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing to say, I'm not saying who I am. It's another thing to lie. And actually, Wales wound up, you know, after a couple of days, backtracking and, you know, and saying, well, this is a problem. But I think it sort of shows some of the difficulties here. And we're on a different kind of turf here. And we're sort of finding the rules.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, I mean, you know, you say you love Wikipedia and it's got a lot of great qualities. I mean, there was a study that showed it per the total number of entries, percentage of entries, the error rate was lower than the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. Well, I think that study actually, you know, proved to be not as optimistic as that
okay.
summary stood.
Right.
It was certain scientific articles. You know, basically, you could get an error in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Yeah. You know, they could say, you know, there's, you know, instead of, you know, 20,000 square feet, there's 21,000 square feet of in some locality. But, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica will never say that this person was investigated for civil rights violations when that's a total fabrication.
Which actually happened with
yes,
Wikipedia.
Yes, yes, yes. So I think that's a different kind of mistake, which is a pretty alarming one if it's you they're writing about.
Point taken. I want to ask also about the changes in our culture that all this is bringing about. I look at my kids, and they are natives to this environment. And I see people, you know, text messaging on their cell phones constantly and listening to their iPods and IMing and watching TV and, you know, perhaps editing a Photoshop file all at the same time, multitasking to the max. But it's more than just the ability to do that. It seems that there's a sort of an acceleration of how people are in dialogue constantly, which to many of us is not certainly very comfortable. But I think that we sense that this is what the next generation is going to be like. And this is basically human culture from this point forward.
And they call it the iPod generation.
Yeah. Well.
And which I find fascinating when you we use Google as a verb. And we say, I go Google something. And the iPod isn't a verb. I don't iPod a song. But iPod's a metaphor, and people use it a lot. They talk about the iPod of X, right, when they mean something that's really wildly successful and a great quality example of something, which is, you know, the success in a field. They also talk about the iPod generation, which doesn't merely describe someone's age, but the behavior of that generation, which you just described very well, of multitasking and going forward, sort of, like an informational ADD thing happening.
Yeah.
Because those options are out there. It's not a question of, previous generations were wired differently. It's a question now they can go other places. They could shuffle, so to speak, their existence and their sources of information and the people that they're in contact with. Just like you shuffle songs on an iPod, they could shuffle news and shopping and the commercials in the Super Bowl. So that's this generation, I think, and that's going to stick with us. It's not a fad because those options, those choices, are always going to be there very, very quickly.
You wrote another very interesting book called Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. This came out, about 16 years ago?
More. It came out in 1984.
Okay. I found some of the notes of the book. I haven't read it, but I want to go back and read it. Very interesting. In which you sort of outline the concept of the hacker ethic. And I'm not sure how much this reflects your own ethic, but I'm curious, so I'm going to ask you. Some of these points are that access to computers should be unlimited and total. That all information should be free, and that computers can and are changing our lives for the better.
Right. Yeah, at the time I wrote that, that was sort of a radical thing to think. Computers seemed like something that you did to figure out your social security, the government had, and track the trajectory of bombs or things like that. Nothing you'd have on your desktop, for instance. Now, when I did those things, I called that the hacker ethic, and it had a certain amount of principles in it. What I was doing was describing the mindset that seemed to be shared to me by people who were hackers. And by hackers, I wasn't talking about people who just broke into computers, but people who were just passionately, deeply involved in the programming of computers and changing the world in that sense. They seemed to all have a shared set of values that involved interacting with the world and fixing things and learning more. And the computer was a great way to map out their intention toward the world. And information should be free because you had to get more information to learn how to program these things and learn about them. It was very hard to come by. It was hard to get time on a computer. And it turned out to be sort of fascinating in that it had almost an implicit political component to it. And years after the book came out, this hacker ethic sort of became central to the open source movement. And the book found a whole new audience of people who were talking about open source. And as it turned out, the last chapter of the book was the first time anyone wrote about this guy who later turned out to be the founder of the open source movement. This guy, Richard Stallman. So that worked out. I'm sympathetic with the hacker ethic. But I'm not a hacker myself. It's not the principles I live by. When you say information should be free, look, I do make content, right?
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, to put it inelegantly. And I'd like to make a living from that. So,
yeah.
But on the other hand, Newsweek is free. You go on the web, yeah, and you could read my column for nothing.
Information should be free, but authors got to pay the mortgage, you know, regardless.
That's true. That's true.
Well, we're just about out of time. I wanted to ask a couple other questions, you know, getting back to your book, The Perfect Thing. It's very interesting. I think it's the first time I've seen this, and probably the first time it's been done. The actual sequence of the chapters is shuffled from copy to copy.
That's right. As I was talking about shuffle before,
yeah,
to me, shuffle is the signature feature of the iPod. It's when, you know, something you couldn't do really before an iPod, where you have a whole music collection and you could just put it in random order and it comes back to you where you don't know what the next song is. And sometimes a song will come up, you don't even realize it was on your iPod. It might be in the middle of some disc you fed in, or you were at your friend's house, and or maybe you went to a music blog and said that's interesting, and something will come up there. So it's a great source of novelty there. So I thought I would write this book sort of in the spirit of the iPod. Each chapter is a different aspect of the iPod, and it stands alone. It's sort of a self-contained, with the exception of the first one, which is sort of an introduction. I kept first in all of them. So what I did was, there's 9 chapters, including the beginning, is I took the 8 chapter names of all the chapters that came after the first one and wrote them on ping pong balls and put it in a basket. And I had my son and my niece, who are both members of the iPod generation, pick the balls out of the bag. And we did a bunch of different shuffles of the book. And I picked 4 that sounded fun. And that's the way the publisher did it. I convinced the publisher to come out that way. So the book that you have in front of you will probably be ordered differently than the one that your friend has.
Before we run out of time, I also wanted to ask you about something that's happening in June, when the iPhone will be released. And, you know, you have a chance to talk with Steve Jobs. You've been studying what's going on at Apple and the industry for a long time. And I'm wondering, you know, if you think that the iPhone is going to be as revolutionary as the iPod.
I think the iPhone is a great product. In a way, it's going to be tough to be as a big an agent of change as the iPod was for the iPhone, because, you know, it really had an opportunity, you know, in terms of interacting with the way you could distribute music and get engaged with music, to change that whole world there of music. I think the tasks you do with the iPhone in terms of a smartphone, organizing your life and also browsing the internet, it does that in a really wonderful way. And I think it's going to be a very popular product. I'm a little curious to see how the battery life will work out and some of those other issues. It's kind of expensive, but of course, as we learned, those prices come down. I'm not quite convinced at this point it'll have that revolutionary nature of the iPod, but certainly it's an incredibly innovative product.
Well, we'll see. The book is The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture and Coolness. The author, our guest, Stephen Levy, he is the technology correspondent for Newsweek magazine. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Stephen Levy, thanks so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.